This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
But there's also a point for a reckoning to come upon this party, and that we have the power finally to demonstrate that if you kill, maim, torture, attack, we will make you lose.
The abandoned Biden movement has become the abandoned Harris movement and focused on defeating Kamala Harris in the battleground states because of her complicity in the genocide in Gaza.
The most important thing is that they were unable to convict us for working for anybody except black people.
The Uhuru 3 free speech trial concludes with a mixed verdict.
We're talking about electric vehicles, we're talking about cell phones and smartphones, and again we see the minerals of the Congo being extracted to fuel these industries at the expense of the Congolese people.
Boris Carney of Friends of the Congo explains how the information age is directly linked to the genocide currently going on in the Congo.
The same intellectual forces and social forces and corporate forces that supported the Nazi movement and the fascist movement in Germany and Italy are at work today.
Journalist and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal addresses a workers' conference on fascism, democracy, and a workers' party. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. The Abandoned Biden Movement was founded last October by Muslim Americans who had resolved not to vote for incumbent President Joe Biden because of his complicity in the Gaza genocide. In August, the group rebranded as Abandoned Harris and vowed to work for Kamala Harris's defeat in the battleground states. I spoke to Dr. Hassan Abdel Salam of Abandoned Harris. Dr. Hassan Abdel Salam, the last time we spoke to you, your group was still Abandoned Biden. When did you change your name to Abandoned Harris?
We changed our name to Abandoned Harris from Abandoned Biden on August 19th, 2024, a few blocks away from the DNC United Center convention, where we said and vowed in clear terms that we will pledge never to vote for the Vice President, Kamala Harris, and that we would actively campaign against her, ensuring her defeat on November 5th.
Did you even consider disbanding and supporting Harris?
Immediately after President Biden dropped out of the race, as we called on him to do on July 11th in Washington, D.C., we again reappeared in front of the Supreme Court, demanding that Vice President Harris speak to us. We extended our hand, asking what was her policy on Gaza, what was her policy on the genocide. We wanted to know exactly what was in her mind, having worked actively with the president the past year since the attacks began, since the genocide began. We wanted to hear from her mouth in front of us what she would do if she became the president on January 20th. And so on July 22nd, we asked the vice president her policy positions. We asked for her to meet with us. The media took our message, our demands for a permanent unconditional ceasefire and a full arms embargo, and we were met with complete rejection. No comment, no meeting. And so that's what led up to our decision that we had no choice but to do what we began in October, that we would denounce the party's position on genocide and proclaim that we will begin a campaign against the vice president that began on August 19th, 2024.
So you're looking to win a moral victory by helping to cost the Democrats the election.
Yes, our strategy is to punish the president and his vice president now running at the top of the ticket for the genocide, such that it be known in history that at the hands of people of conscience, people came out and ensured her defeat in the swing states to send an undeniable signal to the political class that you can never engage in genocide and win.
So you were at the Democratic National Convention. Did you take part in any of the rallies?
Yes, we took part in the rallies on Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday in the streets, in the parks. We spoke to folks, we spoke to the media, we protested. And on Tuesday, alongside Jill Stein, I participated in a rally at Grace Church in Chicago.
So that's one other sort of event that you took part in with Jill Stein. Where did that take place?
At Grace Church.
And who else did you meet with?
At the church.
At the church or at the convention?
Yeah, so Workers Strike Back. We've met with lots of media folks, supporters. We were walking the streets with Cornel West. At our press conference, we had Jill Stein, Claudia de la Cruz. We had Cornel West with us and their supporters, as well as people associated to their campaign. And we were just talking to people from all different backgrounds in the park, people of conscience who are distressed at what they see as a genocide perpetrated by the hands of our own government.
What did you think of Kamala Harris's acceptance speech?
The speech represented to me a remarkable feat in doublespeak, a party that has reached the point, historic, a candidate like Kamala Harris, never before appearing before the nation to possibly be the president of the United States, promising to the American people gifts that we all believe should be part of our nation, universal health care, forgiveness of student debt, fighting climate change, ending police brutality. And yet we shed blood across this planet, a speech that declared and doubled down on what she termed the military dominance of the state of Israel, that she would support, enhance, maintain that military dominance, the type of dominance that's raining bombs on an innocent people, that's killing in the tens of thousands. Now in the past months, estimated above 200,000 have been killed, displaced, injured with post-traumatic stress prevalent throughout a people who see no hope. The fact that I can even utter these words, it's despicable. When we were doing one of the launches in November, one of the people who was going to represent a leader at the press conference in Fort Lauderdale on that November day, he called me a few days before the launch of Abandon Biden. And he told me, I thought it was just a call about logistics, about the launch. And I picked up the phone and he told me, just an hour ago, Brother Hassan, I just learned that I lost 24 members of my family. And I just couldn't hold myself. I started crying and he was very composed, which was truly remarkable. But when I got off the phone, I thought to myself, no American citizen should ever hear uttered into their ear those sentences strung together. The death of their family and friends and colleagues in huge numbers at the hands of the American government, our government.
What do you say to those who will inevitably say that Trump will be worse for Palestinians?
The former president prevented our family and our colleagues and our friends from entering the country, but Kamala Harris killed them. That ultimately the act of murder must be punished. That we have no choice. At Abandon Biden, now Abandon Harris, we have a saying that 4 years under any Republican is incomparable to one day in Gaza. We know we'll have to sacrifice. I myself would just shut down the laptop because I couldn't hear the words of the former president, a despicable candidate. But imagine if we were to come out in droves again as we had in 2020, and we would vote for Kamala Harris. After we protested again and again and again, and we were met with silence, we would reward the very murderer who killed our parents and family, and it would send a signal that you could do anything. You could put us in concentration camps. You could go and shed blood in any part of the world. You can come into our homes and steal our property and take our children away, and we would yet still be told, we had to select you because you are the lesser of two evils. There comes a point where it's true. There might be a moment where we have to choose a lesser of two evils. But there's also a point where the evil is so pronounced, is so inflected, that it's just an evil that you must denounce at every moment and despite the consequence, regardless of the cost. For us to send an undeniable signal with sacrifice and struggle in the next 4 years, for a reckoning to come upon this party, for it to ask as it has before, what can we do to attract the people who didn't vote for us? And that we have the power finally to demonstrate that if you kill, maim, torture, attack, we will make you lose.
It does seem like it's the only thing that the Democrats care about. We can march around in the streets. You can march around in the streets all you want, but all they care about ultimately is how you vote.
Absolutely. It's been a huge struggle. In October, I began seeing the cries of people in the protests. I was there here in Minneapolis on Minnesota pavement, shouting the cry for justice, ceasefire now, ceasefire now, ceasefire now. So emotional to know that this slogan emerged in October months ago. And it spread throughout the nation with people from all backgrounds, African-American, Gen Z, Latinos, progressives, libertarians, conservatives, Democrats, Republicans, Muslim Americans, Jewish Americans, all coming out, singing the song side by side in the encampments, tents erected, there again the cry, ceasefire now. And yet, nothing. In October, I met one of the heads here at a civil rights organization, Brother Jelani Hussein in Minnesota. And I told him I didn't think these protests would work, that the only way the Democratic Party will change its position, that the president will recognize that it was a mistake to persist with this genocide, would be if we showed that we had the power to punish. That we made it clear that we were going to punish because of the genocide, that we came out in droves and voted against the president. And it took some time, and he recognized it was so. And people told us the ceasefire was coming. You made a mistake. You called on November 1st. And again, we've been redeemed. No unconditional permanent ceasefire as per the International Court of Justice has been called. We have no other option sometimes. And this is the moment. Now, with the strategy being clear, we're now weeks away from this election. And we ask everyone to vote against genocide.
CARE estimates that there are roughly 2.25 million Muslim voters. I believe they are especially concentrated in Michigan. Are they concentrated in any of the other battleground states?
The way that we're looking at the data with respect to Muslim Americans and our allies is by examining the population relative to the margins in the polls, recent polling within the states, as well as the margin in 2020. For example, in Arizona, we have a smaller population of Muslim Americans compared to Michigan. But the margin between the two candidates in 2020, because it's recently become a battleground state, was approximately 10,000 votes. We have some estimated over 10 times that number among Muslim Americans in Arizona. And so we are investing incredibly in the state of Arizona, in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Nevada, North Carolina, Florida, and Minnesota. We feel very good about states like Michigan, Arizona, Pennsylvania, and Georgia. And we're also excited about Wisconsin, Nevada, and North Carolina. We hope to join with third-party campaigns and the candidates that lead them, as well as we are calling on all Americans in these swing states to join us. If just a fraction of people of conscience, in the same way who came out to vote uncommitted in the Democratic primaries in 2024, will do the same, we would very easily accomplish our task and deliver the swing states away from the vice president.
Will you be endorsing a third party candidate?
The leadership at Abandon Biden, Abandon Harris has been studying the question of endorsements in February. And I can tell you right now that our leadership, when I speak to them, and this decision will be made democratically by the leadership, are now moving towards an endorsement of a single candidate. It's extremely likely we'll do so, and it's extremely likely it's in September. And so we're very excited about that. We wanted to be sure to study who is the likely candidate with the ballot access, with a clear campaign functioning throughout the country that would unite Americans together for us to make him or her win this election. And when we say win, we say at Abandon Harris, to win is to punish Kamala Harris, to deliver the swing states away from Kamala Harris. By voting for a third party candidate and showing the vote for that third party candidate that didn't go to Kamala Harris, that it's greater than the margin between the two top despicable candidates, the two leaders of the major candidate of the major parties. If we show that we have more votes that were given to that third party candidate, then that separates the two top leaders, the two top candidates of the Republican Democratic Party, we would have achieved our goal of demonstrating that we punished the vice president.
That was Dr. Hassan Abdel Salam of Abandon Harris, a Muslim American group actively campaigning to defeat Kamala Harris in the battleground states.
In the books of history, everyone will see crimes against humanity. People looked away from a life stream genocide. Trucks are full of food supplies, get outside. Telling us the black is white, but the world is seen right through Israeli lies. Using the weapon of hunger, life is a game to these monsters who would starve a child. Every day
that was Palestinian singer Lean, You Will Never Bury Palestine, a rewrite of Israel's Eurovision entry. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. The Uhuru 3 federal trial has concluded with a mixed verdict. Pacifica's Polina Vasilyev reports.
The Uhuru 3 have been found not guilty of being Russian agents in the federal case in Tampa, Florida. On the morning of September 12th, the jury returned a verdict in the free speech trial of African People's Socialist Party Chairman Omali Yeshitela and two leaders of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, Penny Hess and Jesse Neville, on charges of working as Russian agents. The 12-person jury concluded a not guilty verdict on count number 2, quote, failure to register as a foreign agent, in other words, working as agents of Russia. This was the big charge that carried an up to 10-year prison sentence. The Hands Off Uhuru campaign reports the jury contained no black jurors, but to their credit, they saw clearly that African people have agency and sovereignty over their actions. The government presented 14 witnesses, 12 of them FBI agents, while the defense needed to present no witnesses to prove the government's accusation of being Russian agents was fabricated. The jury returned a guilty verdict on count number 1, conspiring against the U.S. government. This charge carries a maximum of 5 years. After the verdict, Chairman Omali Yeshitela and the Uhuru 3 lawyers spoke with supporters and the press on the steps of the Tampa Federal Courthouse. Chairman Omali addressed his supporters.
The most important thing is that they were unable to convict us for working for anybody except black people. That's the most important thing. They could not convict us of working for anybody except black people. They had to say we were not working for the Russians, et cetera, which was critical to this entire thing. And I am willing to be charged and found guilty of working for black people.
Attorney Mutaki Akbar, representing Jesse Neville, said the lawyers are preparing to appeal to ensure all of the baseless accusations are defeated and no prison time is served.
The fight doesn't stop here. We will appeal this. But I think what came out, as the chairman said, was that it's clear that the party has always and consistently worked for the liberation of black people, not Russians, not anybody else. And we can't be bought. We can't be paid for. Right. And we're continuing to fight and continuing to struggle. Right. And I think that's been clear. And that's what's going to continue to happen. So Uhuru means freedom and we're free.
Attorney Leonard Goodman, representing Penny Hess, addressed the conspiracy charge.
The conspiracy charge was incredibly confusing. I don't think the jury understood that it requires them to find that the conspiracy is to act as a Russian agent.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure what the jury was thinking, but as Mutaki said, we're going to appeal and we're going to fight on. This case has always been about the right of free speech and dissent, and that's why they're charged. I mean, if their speech aligned with the government of Ukraine, there'd be no case. If their speech aligned with a government that the United States approved of, it's Russia. It's Russia, Russia, Russia. And the fight's not over.
And here is attorney Addie Griffin, representing Omalia Shetella.
It's been an absolute honor, and I mean it. It's been an honor to represent Omalia Shetella. It's been an honor here with the African People's Socialist Party. I believe in your work. I believe in our cause. I think we did an excellent job on the case. I'm happy with the verdict. I would have obviously liked a not guilty across the board, but considering the goals that we were trying to achieve, we won.
The judge has not set a sentencing date on the conspiracy conviction. The Hands Off Uhuru campaign reports Chairman Omalia Shetella, Penny Hess, and Jesse Neville remain in the community to carry out the Uhuru anti-colonial mission. For Pacifica, I'm Polina Vasilyev.
We shall overcome one day.
That was Mahalia Jackson, We Shall Overcome. Gerald Valray of Block Report Radio sat down with Maurice Carney, Executive Director of Friends of the Congo, to talk about how the information age is directly linked to the genocide currently going on in the Congo.
Can you talk about how the digital information age is taking over the world and how it's fueled by the genocide in the Congo?
Yeah, for sure. You know, the modern devices that we use, the cell phones and the laptops and the electric cars we drive in and the video games that our children play, they are a product of natural resources, strategic minerals that are found in the Congo. For example, coltan is a mineral that is found in the Congo. It's about 64% of the world's reserve of coltan is found in the Congo. And it's a mineral that, when it's refined and processed, it allows you to build smaller devices that are more powerful. And in order to get coltan in the east of the Congo, militia groups displace entire villages so that they can get access to those resources, ship them out of the country, really through Rwanda. Rwanda is one of the main exit points. In fact, although Congo has 64% of the world's reserve of coltan, Rwanda is the largest exporter because Rwanda has its troops in Congo, it supports militia groups in Congo. So it's a gateway for getting minerals out. If you have cobalt, it's another key mineral that's found in a different part of the country, in the south, southeast. And the cobalt is critical to rechargeable batteries. It's a key ingredient in the batteries in your iPhones and your iPads and even the electric cars that you drive. And at the bottom of the supply chain, the digging up of cobalt, you often see children that are engaged. There's a question of child labor. The people who dig out the cobalt, they call them artisanal or small-scale miners. They use rudimentary tools that have them exposed to radioactive materials. They dig tunnels into the ground and cave in and asphyxiate them. So there's a lot of dangers involved. In fact, we are collaborating with attorney Terry Collinsworth of International Rights Advocates, who brought suit against Apple and Tesla and Microsoft and Google and Dell on the behalf of 16 Congolese children and their families, because those companies were sourcing minerals from the Congo that were tainted with child labor. And so that's how not just Apple, but a range of companies, the entire tech sector, is connected to the Congo. And JR, it's important for us to really have a historic view of this, right? Well, when we talk about Congo, we're talking about a colonial state. It was designed for extraction. Right. So at the start of the design of the Congo, 1884, 1885, right to 1908, 23-year period, the technological advance at the time was rubber tires, right? So the rubber in the Congo was extracted to fuel, you know, Western industries. The automobile industry eventually, first the bicycle and then auto industry. When we got to World War II and there were technological advances, the United States had developed the atomic weapons that it ultimately dropped on Japan. It was the uranium from Congo that was extracted, you know, to power the Western, you know, war machine, right? And fast forward to today, the 21st century, we're talking about electric vehicles, we're talking about cell phones and smartphones, and again, we see the minerals of the Congo being extracted to fuel these industries at the expense of the Congolese people. So the big lesson and takeaway, one of them anyway, is that we're still, as Africans, Congolese, living a colonial experience. And in order to shatter that umbilical cord, that colonial infrastructure, we have to organize around that. And it's not a boycott that's going to deliver that. It's going to be the masses of people around the world, working class, poor people, mobilizing in a way to support folks on the front lines in the Congo, in a way to withdraw ourselves from the consumption pattern, that the conspicuous consumption that we see, this capitalist society that has glamorized for us, that ultimately fuels death and destruction, not just in the Congo, but throughout Africa and the global south, where the bulk of the resources that are found that fuel modern amenities and technological devices and our way of life in the United States and other Western countries.
Can you give your opinion of the boycott movement that people are pushing, where they're boycotting new technological products, as well as slash refurbished movement that is taking shape, especially during this time when the new iPhone is scheduled to make its debut?
Yes, thank you for that question. A number of folks are asking us about that. I think as symbolically, right, I understand it. However, we were just in the mines in the Congo with the diggers. And if you talk to any of the diggers in the cobalt mines and the copper mines, boycott is not on the top of their list in terms of prescription as to what we ought to be demanding of the tech companies. One, they talk about assistance in formalizing the mining sector so they can get better equipment, better materials, better tools, or more protection, greater security. Two, they talk about what Tony Collinsworth brought in his suit, restoration, reparation for the destruction of the environment, for the loss of family members, to apply pressure and make those kind of demands on these companies. The thing about a boycott is that the miners at the bottom of the supply chain have not been consulted. We don't see the same process as the boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign that the Palestinians are heading up, the BDS, where those who are most affected, are part of the process. You don't see the miners, cobalt diggers and the copper diggers out in the front saying boycott Apple. So I think a more studied, thought-out process ought to be pursued when it comes to questions of boycott. Boycott is a byproduct of grounding with organizers, afflicted communities, and then you come out with a unified voice saying, this is our position. You know, boycott Apple or Samsung or whatever for these reasons. So I don't see that process in place. So it appears to me that the process is reactionary. But right now, that's what it's looking like. Now, if you want to boycott Apple and Samsung and others and not upgrade, I think you have to do that within the context of curbing your contribution to the capitalist monster, right? Your consumption patterns. The Apples and the Samsungs and all, they make their money because of our conspicuous consumption. So it's really a fundamental shift that is needed. Saying you're going to boycott may actually be an opt-out, as opposed to saying so this capitalist system is destructive to us as, you know, U.S. citizens. It's destructive to the Congolese, and we're basically turning over a new leaf. We're exiting from this base of conspicuous consumption, and we're going to change the way in which we, you know, we consume so that we don't fuel these major corporations that wreak havoc around the world. So that's what I would offer as it relates to the question of boycotting Apple or any of the major tech companies.
Germany is in the news right now because they are considering paying Rwanda so that they can relocate migrants from Germany to the African nation. And this is after England originally created this plan with Rwanda. Can you talk about how the genocides in places like the Congo and the Sudan and Haiti, how do they contribute to the migration crisis in the Western world in places like Europe and the United States?
Well, first of all, migration crisis, as you put it, is really a crisis of capitalism, a crisis of imperialism. There's a wonderful film out entitled Harvest of Empire, which really speaks to how the empire harvests migrants. It is because of what we talked about earlier, the extractive system, the exploitative system by Western corporations, where they go into the global south and they plunder the resources there. The governments work in cahoots with the corporations to assure that pliable authoritarian leaders are put in place so that they can have unfettered access to the wealth of those countries. And in extracting the wealth of those countries, they leave nothing for the people. So the people have to get up and move to where they can find or make a basic standard of living. They can feed their families. They can send their children to school. So the migration crisis is a crisis of capitalism. It's a crisis of imperialism. And that's what we ought to be targeting and challenging, the way in which Western governments, Western corporations plunder the global south. Now, you mentioned Germany. You mentioned the United Kingdom in relation to Rwanda being a source for the disposing, let's say, of people from Germany or from the UK. Well, before the UK and before Germany, there was Israel. Right, Israel was the first space in which Rwanda engaged in that type of activity. Right, and we see Rwanda, it's a neocolonial state, which basically serves the interests and responds to the beck and call of the West. So when Netanyahu said we wanted to get rid of these migrants or refugee, these asylum seekers, Rwanda stepped up and said, well, bring them to Rwanda. So that's an example, that model of Rwanda, a neocolonial state, serving the interests of the West. So this is nothing necessarily new. This is basically an example of how a neocolonial state responds to the metropole. So this is important for us to point out, because Rwanda is often put up as a model for the rest of Africa. And these agreements that Rwanda has entered into and continue to enter into shows and demonstrates to the people that it is Paul Kagame. Rwanda government is nothing more than a puppet of the West, because the solution isn't accepting the sending away or the shipping out of asylees to the global south. But the solution lies in challenging the capitalist system, dismantling the capitalist system, dismantling the imperialist system that produces the crisis in the first place.
How can people get more information on Friends of the Congo?
Right now, I would highly recommend they go to congoweek.org. Congoweek.org, we have a global teaching delegation coming from the Congo, a tour that's going to kick off in a few weeks, and we want people to be a part of it, to learn from folks, to hear from folks from the front lines in the Congo. So we highly recommend that they go to congoweek.org, click on that events calendar that's there, and sign up to be a part of the global teaching on the Congo. That's the best way for people to be engaged with us at the very moment.
When is Congo Week?
Congo Week runs from October 13th through the 19th. However, we have a series of events that is taking place starting on Climate Week in New York on September 20th through September 30th. And then we'll be going to different cities throughout the U.S. And we'll be in the Oakland, San Francisco Bay Area from October 21st through October 31st. But we'll also be in Atlanta. We'll be in D.C., Washington, D.C. We'll be in Boston. We'll be in Chicago. We'll be in Los Angeles. But you go to congoweek.org and click on the events calendar and sign up to be a part of the global teaching and the Congo tour, the Free Congo tour, and you'll be able to stay up to date on where we're going to be over the next 45 days in the United States.
That was Maurice Carney, Executive Director of Friends of the Congo, speaking to J.R. Valray of Block Report Radio. You can find more from J.R. at Block Report Radio on Instagram.
With a batch pan matches, I'm black without apology, no feelings, no suppress. Africa, the motherland, understand the richest continent. When me ready, me a step, me no go fear, no consequence. See them, I come with them weakness and the pretense in a frequency. And I press button on a weak fence. King Marks, I come with the defense. Black star line pan the seat when we are steam left enemies. Them want me reduce my lineage to a state of misery. LK Malcolm get shot, I give speech. Look where the civil rights country I preach. Man, I get shot, cut them off, I be free. And a fruit is a man where you hang from a tree. Can't move, get stopped like a gotary. Revolution spread like a margarine. Cause I'm black, why the bad and a free. If you pay women off to foreign embassies. Them a left here trauma. Look what them did, the African daughter. Gone like a thief in the night to their mother. King Leopold could never father. The mother African man when slaughter. Come with the Bible when I take your offer. African spiritual system a rather. Chop me arm and leg and teach me black. Turn round want me be patriot. See a colonist country and miss me with that thing. Royal African a big idiot. Napoleon a go on like him never come squat. And a native than a year to we call that. Liberty equality the French them a chat. But them never mean the ones in a France where they black.
That was Yeeza and Rory Stone Love. Is it because I'm black? This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. A dangerous heat wave is engulfing the world and is having deadly consequences for those who work outdoors, including UPS truck drivers and roofers. At a Los Angeles workers' conference, Teamster Local 396 UPS worker William Pena spoke to Pacifica's Steve Seltzer about the need for union action to stop heat-induced deaths.
My name is William Pena. I'm out of Teamsters Local 396 in Los Angeles. I'm a 30-year member of the union, 30-year veteran, 97 strike veteran as well.
And why don't you talk about this heat wave? Because Southern California, this country, is facing a very grave climatic situation for working people, and especially those workers are outside on the roofs or on the driving trucks. What's it like, and what should be done about it?
It's complete hell in the trucks right now. I mean, it seems like every other day a worker's dying, and nobody's doing anything about it. It's just swept under the rug by both the company and the union, and we need more action. We need more action by the company and the union. And I feel nothing's going to happen unless workers rally around, that have, that work outside, that work in trucks. If we rally together and we push our leaders to do the right thing, if not, nothing's going to happen, and it's just going to keep getting swept under the rug. And I just want to mention that I tell everybody, if you did this in another country that's heavily unionized, with the amount of deaths that we're having right now, especially in the South and Texas, people in, I've heard of members dying in Florida, if it would be a general strike. Nobody would go to work, and there would be immediate change right away. And it's, I don't know what it is about this country that doesn't value workers' lives. We need to start valuing our lives. We need to start taking care of each other, and we have to start looking out for each other as workers.
And the company, UPS, said they were going to air condition. They can put air conditioning in the trucks. Why is it not happening?
We don't know why it's not happening. I don't have an answer. The only thing that I've heard is because supposedly profits are down, and that's something that was in the contract, that only if profits were up, then they would go ahead and purchase new vehicles for the fleet. But that's all I know about that. So I can't really say why.
I mean, it sounds like a national emergency for workers. I mean, workers are dying all over the place. I mean, shouldn't this government, the California government, declare an emergency and demand that these companies install air conditioning in trucks?
Well, yes, of course. I'll go a step further. I think that you know, our union leaders should be going to the members' homes, to the funerals, and apologizing to those families, because these deaths could be stopped right now if the contract was enforced and if we had some actual labor law that protected workers in the heat with teeth, you know, and make these greedy corporations pay for what they're doing right now.
It doesn't even seem like that's an issue in the campaign. There's a national election campaign. Worker deaths because of heat doesn't even seem to be an issue.
It doesn't. It doesn't seem to be an issue. It's like normal. We've normalized this, and I just can't wrap my head around how we treat, like I said, how we treat the workers here in this country. It's just unbelievable. I mean, something needs to happen, and it needs to happen now. And we can't wait. Global warming is here. I was just in the area of California that was 115 degrees. You can't work in that. It's impossible to work in that, especially in a truck. If you're in the back of the truck, it's another 10 degrees. So you say it's 100 out here in LA, it's going to be 110 in the back of your truck. Those are deadly-ish. Those are deadly conditions. And I'm going to mention another thing that nobody talks about. We just went through a deadly pandemic. We were frontline workers. A lot of us caught COVID. We didn't even know if we had it or not. And as you know, COVID attacks your heart, it attacks your lungs, it attacks your brain. So if you're in the back of the truck with you know, and your immune system is down because of that, that's an issue. Also, one other thing is they're making people come into work with COVID, or else management is going to write you up right now. I think that's another issue that's not being talked about a lot, you know, and that's something that needs to be, you know, that needs to be enforced. We need to stay home when we're sick, because when we're out there in the road in the heat, we're going to experience, you know, heat-related injury or even up to death. So it's really important that we start talking about these issues right now.
And Gavin Newsom has cut back on Cal OSHA. There are less than 200 OSHA inspectors. Have there been any OSHA inspections of these trucks? I mean, it's heat. They have a heat standard in California. Are they enforcing it?
No, they're not enforcing anything. I have not seen any kind of enforcement whatsoever. OSHA coming out to our buildings or asking any type of questions, you know, or you know, holding our safety. We have safety committees, and those they're ineffective. They really don't do anything for us, and that needs to also be overhauled. I mean, the answer is, if we as workers don't demand better working conditions, we're not going to get them. And it's going to take leadership. It's going to take workers to organize themselves. It's going to take the whole labor movement in order for this to happen.
You think the leadership of that should be, the union should be demanding it of Governor Newsom and the politicians?
Absolutely. The union should be demanding that of the politicians, Governor Newsom, our state reps, all the way down to our city council people. I also think that our union leaders should be holding UPS accountable for what they're doing right now, and it's not happening. It's because we're too bound by this labor peace, which is in our contract. I think labor peace, when a member dies, it goes out the window. And I'm the type of person that says, you know what, an injury to one is an injury to all. We need a strike, and we need a strike for those air conditionings in our truck.
That was Teamster Local 396 UPS worker William Pena calling for workers' action to stop heat-induced deaths at UPS. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Millions of working people are angry about the so-called choices that we have in the 2024 elections. Journalist and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal spoke at a workers' conference in Los Angeles on fascism, democracy, and a workers' party, sponsored by Roofers Local 36. Here are his comments.
Not choices for working people, because what both parties and these neo-conservative and neoliberal movements present is the sale of their party to the highest bidder. To suggest that the corporate elites, the wealthy, the super wealthy, are in control of these parties is but to state the obvious. The only thing they don't control is independent workers who gather together to defend their class interests and the interests not just of their people, but of all people, of the common people of the world. That can be done, but it must be a conscious effort by people who want to see social transformation, not just along the cheap integers of race or gender, but of class, more importantly, what? Consciousness. It is only those forces that can really move us forward. And I say that as someone who looked on, I mean, I was critical, but I looked on during the inauguration of the Obama administration. And yeah, let's be honest, I was filled with hope, but that hope did not spring eternal. I was filled with other emotions afterwards. It was really disappointment. What could have been and what did not happen. And I think we're teeing ourselves up to the same ball play, the same game, this time along the lenses of gender and race. So what we need now is people who dare to talk about not just the middle class.
This is a call from Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Mahanoy.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
But working classes and the poor. You know, nobody talks about poor people. And there are millions and millions of poor people in this country who can barely survive. So I salute all of you for what you're doing. I find it remarkable. And we need more of this, but we need it all across this vast country.
What are the feelings about the Obama administration in the aftermath?
It was a tremendous lost opportunity. If you think about it, I mean, his administration was a time of great reward to the corporations that were considered too big to fail. I mean, they made money hand over fist. They made public money, right? The government gave them really what our tax dollars, so that they could not fall. Wouldn't it be remarkable to think about a family as something too important to fail, right? Or a small business, but we haven't gotten there yet. And so all we really did was rebuild capitalism on an insecure foundation, right? Because the same forces that brought us the mortgage crisis of that era, they're out there now building new bubbles. This time what I think is a real estate bubble. And, you know, so until we begin to dare to speak and think and act in an anti-capitalist fashion, we will have bubble after bubble and bubble burst and public monies from the people rendered to save corporates that don't give a damn about the poor or workers or anybody else but themselves.
What do you think will stop fascism?
Radical democracy and the understanding right, that we have been here before, right? Think about this. The same intellectual forces and social forces and corporate forces that supported the Nazi movement and the fascist movement in Germany and Italy are at work today, right? To bring forth what I call this neo-fascist moment. And what is fascism but the convergence of the state and capital, right? And, you know, if we don't fight this thing, we'll see things that our grandfathers and grandmothers could never have dreamed of. I mean, we will see dread and horror and ugliness. And what else will we see? We'll see this great leap to what? To war. Because the defense industries never tire of selling weapons to support wars that the people are not really in support of. You know, they'll talk all this talk just to get sons and daughters of the people allied and in support of wars. I thought we learned something from Iraq, right? The big lie about weapons of mass destruction. And here we are a generation later, walking that same path. So, you know, we've got to learn from the past, or we are doomed to repeat.
Finally, Mumia, what do you think, why do you think someone like Trump appeals to so many Americans?
Well, I think there's been an illusion. When I listen to people call up and talk about, you know, their anxieties and their fears and their concerns and their wishes, what I hear very often is, well, you don't need a politician, you need a businessman. I laugh when I hear that because Trump is many things, but let's be real now, a businessman or a good businessman, he ain't. I mean, how many bankruptcies do you have to have before you're a failed businessman? And, but people, I think poor people and working class people have been conditioned to do what? To worship the wealthy, right? I mean, like, it ain't a stretch to think about, like, the Kardashians running for high office because they'll get millions of votes because of their fame and fortune, right? The poor and the working class have been conditioned from old England and much of Europe to worship the wealthy, to worship the lords, the princes, the kings. In America, there are no kings and princes, but there are wealthy people. They're the princes of capital. And we worship them. They can do no wrong. And in every sense, even in a legal sense, they truly are immune from unlike anybody else. So, you know, we got to stop worshiping and bowing to people, no matter how much they have. Because much of what they've gotten is ill-gotten gains. They stole it from the workers. They stole it from the poor. You know, if you lived in New Jersey and you saw how do you, like, bankrupt a casino? I can't figure that one out. You know, when money comes through that place like water running in a river, how do you, like, bankrupt that? Well, it happens, you know. So that's what I think, y'all.
That was journalist and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal speaking at a workers' conference in Los Angeles on September 7, sponsored by Roofers Local 36. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Seltzer, J.R. Valray, Polina Vasiliev, and myself, Ann Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.